Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Boy, there's a lot going on. I tried to cram all of it in my newsletter this morning. You have Trump's big, not really, lawsuit against Facebook, which is really just kind of a fundraising scam, but you knew that. The right's sudden fascination and enthusiasm for cameras in the classroom, which is an interesting twist here. Surge in the happiness index, according to Gallup, and of course, we continue to have the pratfall of this new website that Jason Miller created. Is it pronounced Getter? I don't know. Matt Lewis from the Daily Beast joins me. Matt, is it pronounced Getter? How do we pronounce that?
I'm calling it Getter.
Getter, yeah, Getter. Not going well. So there's a lot I want to talk about, including your piece about J.D. Vance being the avatar of corruption in the GOP. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the New York City election and all of this stuff. I want to talk about this amazing anti-vaxxer surge on Fox News and Charlie Kirk and all of these guys. But I did want to comment on one thing, which is this ongoing evolution of Trumpian January 6th trutherism. And, you know, we've gone from it was Antifa, it wasn't our people, to, okay, it was our people, but it wasn't that bad. They were peaceful tourists. And then it sort of became, it was an inside job by the FBI. And then it was sort of like, what insurrection? We're just going to forget about it. This latest development, though, is interesting. And I would like your thoughts on this. Trump now embracing this whole protesters as martyr narrative. I think Jonathan Chait had a really good piece, you know, the chilling message of Trump's embrace of the Ashley Babbitt martyrdom. What he's basically saying is January 6th is now this heroic uprising for the movement. I mean, it's sort of gone along from, okay, it was terrible, we deplore it, to, no, this was this heroic culmination of a righteous uprising. And I just got the sense we're going to be hearing this, you know, who shot Ashley Babbitt thing. And here's a little soundbite from, I feel I need to apologize for this. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who went on, what was she on here? Newsmax, saying that she would have been really good friends with Ashley Babbitt because she was this passionate patriot, and she really kind of compares Ashley Babbitt to the murder, you know, to George Floyd. Let's play the soundbite of Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Ashley Babbitt, you two, I think, would have been friends.
Oh, God.
I'm sure we would have. She seems like she was a very passionate patriot and a very proud Trump supporter, which I really appreciate that. And she was also a veteran. So I'm thankful for her service to the country. I've already been speaking about Ashley Babbitt. I've also met with her attorneys as well. And I think it's very important for her family to know who killed her, because if this country can demand justice for someone like George Floyd, then we can certainly demand justice for Ashley Babbitt. And everyone deserves to know who killed her, not just seeing a gun and a hand on a video clip. But we need to know who it is. And this is also why, you know, I've been against the January 6th commission and the committee that Nancy Pelosi wants to carry forward. She just wants a witch hunt. But I'm more than willing to serve on that committee to stand up for President Trump, for all Republicans in Congress, and to stop the witch hunt, but also to demand answers like Ashley Babbitt, who killed her.
So this is interesting, isn't it, Matt? I mean, we've gone the full circle now around from, boy, that was really terrible, to, you know what? They were heroes. They were martyrs. And those cops, what bastards. They killed innocent, heroic Ashley Babbitt, who would have been hanging out and doing stuff with Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, Christian Vanderbrook yesterday had a tweet where he was talking about the evolving narratives, right? About, oh, these were just people having a picnic. They were hugging each other, maybe now they're heroes. You know, it keeps changing. And I said, like, well, in fairness, January 6th wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for, like, Italian satellites and North Koreans who snuck through the main harbor. And, of course, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And, of course, don't forget the Chinese bamboo.
The bamboo ballots, fibers. Yeah.
So, you know, I think part of it is throw whatever you can against the wall and see what narrative sticks. Some of these are obviously like mutually exclusive theories. Oh, I forgot about the fact that it was actually Antifa, right?
That was the, beginning.
That's the other one.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, obviously, I think what's happening is that revolutions need martyrs. And ironically, Ashley Babbitt, I guess, is becoming that. Somebody pointed out on Twitter that, you know, George Floyd was like allegedly trying to pass off like counterfeit $20 bills. That was his crime that got him killed. Ashley Babbitt was, you know, in the middle of an insurrection that was like trying to murder the vice president. And so I'm not sure perfect analogy that they want.
No. And of course, these are mutually contradictory, but I think we've seen the ability of certain folks to hold completely contradictory ideas in their head at the same time. And I'm trying to remember that sort of, you know, decision matrix about how people would defended Trump. This goes back to, I think, to 2017. You know, he didn't say it. It's not true. Okay, it may be true, but this is misinterpreted to, okay, he said it. We're going to ignore it. No, he said it and he's completely right. I mean, it's interesting how this sort of evolution, and I just wonder how widespread it's going to be now, the complete embrace that January 6th was righteous and these people are martyrs. You can see it's been percolating for a while. And even Trump has pushed this, and Vladimir Putin was citing it. You know, these poor political martyrs who are being held in prison, and this is just awful. I don't know. Speaking of strange devolutions, I am really struck by how aggressively the conservative media has gone on the anti-vaxxer thing. I mean, it is just within the last 24 hours, you got Candace Owen. Not one person in my family will ever touch the COVID vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine. That's a decision we have made unabashedly as a family. Medical freedom is an individual right that should never, all caps, be infringed upon. Any person who thinks otherwise has no place in our government. I'm not sure who thinks of mandatory vaccine. But anyway, Fox host, the host of this, the focus of this administration on vaccines is mind-boggling, really. Charlie Kirk, comparing vaccination guidelines to apartheid. Let's see here. Here's a Laura Ingraham show. Fox News warns that anybody under the age of 30 should not get the vaccine. And then they, of course, then attack the left and Fauci for being pro-vaccine. I don't know, Matt. I mean, I understand the individual choice thing, but given the spread of the variant, the Delta variant, and the danger that this still poses, it just seems so weird that this has become such a thing on the right, especially because, I mean, in an alternative reality, they could give Trump credit for this vaccine, right?
Right. And in fact, in an alternative reality, they do. This is another example of how there are really two narratives here. Every once in a while, somebody says, hey, you know, in fact, I think there was a piece in the Washington Post by a conservative saying like, hey, Donald Trump should get credit for Operation Warp Speed. I think it was Mark Thiessen, former Bush speechwriter, basically said Joe Biden is making a mistake. It's Joe Biden's fault. Joe Biden should be giving Donald Trump credit because Trump is actually the one behind Operation Warp Speed. He's the one who made this miracle of Western civilization, you know, the vaccine possible. And so that narrative is out there, but clearly it's not the dominant narrative. The dominant narrative now is this culture war against vaccines, which I think is really insane. Something like, what is it, like 96% of the people who are now dying from COVID are people who were not vaccinated, which is exactly what you would expect based on what we were told about the vaccine, the amount of protection that it would provide. I think you would have to be pretty stupid at this point not to get a vaccine. Other people in other countries can't get it. America, we're like, we'll give you a gun. I mean, Charlie, I live in West Virginia. We're like literally like, we'll give you guns. We'll give you money if you get a vaccine. Like, we are begging people get a vaccine. And now the latest thing, which really is angering me, is, you know, there's a talk about going door to door in like rural communities to try to like encourage people to get vaccinated and maybe even do it right there. And there are conservatives now, including Dan Crenshaw, who are basically, you know, making a big stink about this. And like, this is like somehow this is like a Nazi, you know, thing that we're going to be encouraging people to actually vaccinate themselves against a deadly virus.
So what is with Dan Crenshaw? That's a really good point, because Dan Crenshaw is, I always get blowback when I say this, but he's a smart guy. He's an intelligent guy. He knows what's actually going on. You're basically, it's like, you know, the welcome wagon. It's like the Jehovah's Witnesses. You're knocking on people's doors. You're offering them something. You're not kicking down their doors and forcing them at gunpoint. This is not a forceful thing. This is an outreach program. People go door to door. I'm guessing that Dan Crenshaw went door to door when he was running for office. Politicians do this all the freaking time. And yet he's decided that he's going to play this card, that somehow there's something threatening and ominous about this.
Yeah. So, door-to-door campaigning is probably the most effective sort of campaigning you can do because it's personal and there's a lot of reasons. And I think that if, you know, Joe Biden's at like, we're like at what, 67%, you know, have had one shot and didn't reach the target of 70%. And this is like a good way to try to bump up those numbers. I mean, I do think it would be awesome if Donald Trump actually would come out in favor and encourage people and maybe try to take credit. That's on Donald Trump to do that. I think the door-to-door thing is a good idea. And not only are people like Dan Crenshaw discouraging people from getting vaccines, which is a life and death thing, but I think they're actually jeopardizing the safety of, you know, people who may be going door to door.
Yes.
Trying to vaccinate people. It's a very serious thing. And look, I've written off Dan Crenshaw. I don't think we can write off everybody who wasn't always with us the whole time, right? Because like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger didn't vote for the first. I don't think they voted for the first impeachment, which I think Trump was like guilty as sin and should have been impeached the first time. But I don't think we can like hold everybody permanently accountable, because there'd like be nobody left. Having said that, I think that Crenshaw has demonstrated many, many, many times that the degree to which he sounds occasionally serious and competent is like more the exception than the standard. He always will revert back to this sort of demagogic politics. And I know that there are other people sort of in our lane, Charlie, who are really hoping that he becomes a voice for good. I just don't think it's going to happen. And then the last thing I'll say before I shut up is the other really disappointing thing about him, I think, is that he's a Navy SEAL. I mean, you would think that someone who can go through the sort of training that they go through. If you listen to McRaven's speech, that commencement speech at 2014 at UT, famously about how to make your bed or why you should make your bed every morning, the training that they go through is grueling, and not just physically grueling. I mean, their whole goal is to get you to quit the training. Right. It's like, I think, 6 months at Coronado. So someone who goes through that, you would think would have like the honor, courage, and commitment that you would want for a politician. But apparently it doesn't translate to political courage.
No, and it's, you know, I wonder whether it's even a matter of cowardice or courage, or whether it is just sort of the dopamine hit of being part of this tribe. What you have to say to be accepted, what you have to say to be the rock star, getting the positive feedback. Because I was actually reading an article in American Greatness. I may write something about it where it's, which is a super Trumpy publication, but they're kind of pointing out all of Trump's failings and what he didn't accomplish, how he didn't destroy the oligarchy. And it does occur to me that, yes, we have a cult of personality, but we've also sort of launched this vortex of weirdness and extremism, of alienation and permanent anger. I mean, you know, you've been writing about this for years, the grievance industries out there. And at some point, they become self-perpetuating. And that has nothing to do with Donald Trump. I mean, they were there. The grievance industries were there before Trump, and they're going to be there after Trump. So obviously, we live in a world where it's springtime for demagogues. And so what a surprise. If all of the incentive structures encourage demagoguery, why should we be surprised when we have, you know, hot and cold running demagogues?
Here's the other problem, Charlie. And I'm a fan of the Electoral College. On principle, I'm a fan of, you know, I'm not concerned that North Dakota has two senators, just like California. Like I'm down with that. However, what has happened because this system is right now rigged toward the Republican Party? We really don't have a free market of ideas,
no.
You know, like in a normal world, like in a free market, if you were putting forward, you know, crazy ideas that could not get a majority of support in this country politically, you would be forced to change or lose, right? And so there would be that immediate feedback mechanism that tells you, hey, you've gone too far, you better readjust, recalibrate. Instead, we have like, I guess what you would call maybe like a resource curse,
yeah.
You know, where Republicans don't actually have to respond to the free market warning signs. And in a sense, it's sort of like protectionism.
This is a very good point.
So the system now is allowing them to create an inefficient, inferior product and not actually have to lose elections because of it.
You know, I didn't know that I was going to get to this, but let me just play this very, very short soundbite, which you've heard and you've probably commented on. Chip Roy, who is a Texas congressman who has had these spasms of good sense but has been drawn into this vortex as well, is caught on tape. I think he's talking to some fundraising group or some think tank. I'm not even sure what it was. Chip Roy talking about how, you know, the goal of the Republican Party is just to stop anything from happening, complete obstructionism. Let me just play a very, very short clip of Congressman Chip Roy.
Honestly, right now, for the next 18 months, our job is to do everything we can to slow all of that down to get to December 2022 and then get in here and leave.
Yeah, I mean, and it goes on saying, you know, we want to create chaos. And I was asked about this, you know, last night, and I said, there's absolutely nothing surprising about that. Absolutely not. This is exactly what the base wants to hear. This is their position. They've staked out that, you know, the whole owning the libs and trolling culture is all about obstruction and creating chaos. It's not, they don't even pretend that they're trying to solve these problems in the real world. And it's interesting because he was talking about infrastructure. And I had a tasteless thought, if you'll indulge me for a moment. I'm trying to imagine a meeting of the condominium association at a certain Florida condominium. The people who would argue, we don't need to spend any money on repairs. We don't need to do that. Were these fiscal conservatives? Were these responsible people? What would we do to describe the people who actually actively obstructed fixing that condominium? Do you know what I mean?
There's a lot to that, including like, who are these experts to tell us?
Yeah.
Like what? I can't, that's fake news, man. I don't, you know, these so-called experts coming in telling us that my building, you think you know more about my building than I do? You know? Yeah. It's, there's something there, Charlie.
Well, and again, to your point though, is that Chip Roy knows that they will pay given the, you know, the redistricting and the imbalance in the United States Senate and everything. He knows that he will pay no political price for the complete obstruction of this, even though, you know, I think the majority of people would actually like to have roads fixed and bridges fixed and all these other things. Because I want to move on to a couple of other things, including, and I want to get to the Biden coalition, and I want to get to J.D. Vance. I was reading a piece by Rudy Teixeira. Is that how you pronounce it? Who I think is a man after your own heart, even though he is a liberal, you're not. I apologize in advance, but he has a newsletter called The Liberal Patriot. He's a liberal Democrat, but he understands the problems of the coalition. He has a piece saying why the current Democratic strategy probably won't work. The Biden boom's not enough. He says, you know, the Democrats are betting on economics and healthcare to break the midterm curse, but he says it's not going to be enough to tilt the playing field decisively. To do that, they will need to overcome suspicions of the party that have to do with other more culturally inflected concerns. That in turn will require the party to take some stances that the ascendant left in the party will likely oppose for ideological reasons. And the number one issue he cites is crime. that at this point, you know, whatever you want to cite, you want to cite the statistics, more and more Americans are thinking this is a major crisis. It's happening under Joe Biden's watch. There is a suspicion that the Democrats don't get it, that Eric Adams' victory in New York City Democratic mayoral primary should really have been a dramatic signal to the Democratic Party about how they should message. But I'm not sure that they will fully take it on board. What are your thoughts? I know you've talked about this. You talked with Josh Kroshauer the other day on your podcast about this.
I wrote a piece, Charlie, back in March saying Biden had it right on crime in 1993. Now he's in trouble. And I went on to say, you know, if violent crime rates keep rising like they have over the last year, it will reaffirm long-held stereotypes about bleeding heart liberalism. And I think that's true. I mean, it's not really fair. The violent crime rate, which is the problem right now, has actually been rising before Biden got elected. But it's happening on his watch. And I think for a Democrat, if this starts to spiral out of control on his watch, it would just sort of reinforce those stereotypes. And, you know, there's also stuff like critical race theory happening in schools, Afghanistan, which I'm with Bill Kristol on this one. I think it's a big mistake to sort of follow after Donald Trump, you know, with negotiating with the Taliban and withdrawing over there. I think it's a mistake. And who knows how that's going to go. But Joe Biden may just be immune to some of this, right? He's Teflon. He just keeps like eating ice cream cones, and God love him. I love to see the man, mm-hmm. you know, just having a good time. And he's so likable. I like Joe Biden. I just wonder if like Biden is replicable. Like Biden is sort of special. He, for some reason, he gets a pass on all of this. But like, what about the midterms? Or what about whoever? Is there a Democrat who could succeed Joe Biden, who could get away with these really brewing problems that are happening right now, many of which are actually not Biden's fault, some of which may be. Biden may not pay the price, but I don't think Democrats fully appreciate, because, you know, look, you look at it and you're like, Donald Trump was such a joke. The Republican Party is such a mess. Democrats should have a pretty easy ride, but actually they're not gonna.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I was writing down some of the major challenges faced by the Biden administration right now. And obviously, number one is crime. Number two would be inflation, if it actually does rear its head. Race. Then you get to issues like whether he's standing up to Russia on the hacking and Afghanistan. Now, I guess I'm more on the, and I kind of surprised myself on this, more dovish end on Afghanistan. I'm just sick of the war. I'm sick of the endless war. And I think that our appetite for that has been completely exhausted. On the other hand, if in fact the Taliban do, as they appear to be in the process of overrun Afghanistan, we're going to have some horrible imagery. Yeah.
I'm curious about the sick of the war thing, because like, does it feel like, I mean, if I'd asked you, I mean, now it kind of does because people are talking about Afghanistan, but 6 months ago or a year ago, did it even feel like we were at war? It seems to me that we had kind of settled things down. We had like a large enough reserve force in Afghanistan to keep things from spiraling out of control. And we weren't really suffering many casualties. I personally wouldn't have a problem with doing that in perpetuity. And I know some people will freak out when I say that, but like we've got people in, you know, in South Korea, we've got people Europe. In Europe.
Okay, well, that would be an analogy. I guess part of it was, you know, I remember watching the movie based on Jake Tapper's book, which is a real story, and watching these American soldiers being pinned down in this stupidly located base. And I think part of it is just the futility of it. Like, why are we there? Why? I mean, what is the point? No, you make a point about the just holding things in stasis. But I guess the point I was trying to make is I understand that if you polled it today, I think a strong majority of Americans would support the decision to get out of Afghanistan. But if in fact it does fall apart, it will contribute. The optics will contribute to a sense of weakness and defeat and retreat. And I think that hurts. And I think the danger for Biden is that while people like him, there is that nagging concern that he is old and Kamala Harris is unready. So the old and unready, and perhaps there are other forces out there. That's the narrative which you keep hearing. And so those are the real dangers, you know, crime, inflation, the culture war stuff, race, sense of weakness. Now, again, the counter to that is there's this new Gallup poll showing us that Americans are kind of happy, that we're feeling we're thriving, that we're kind of coming back. So I go back and forth between thinking, you know, we maybe spend too much, and I mean you and me here, too much time, you know, listening to the cable talking heads and looking at the punditry and looking at Twitter, and in which things are very, very complicated, when in the real world, things are actually not going that badly. I mean, is there possibly a disconnect there?
Oh, yeah. And I have to say, I mean, to be honest, I'm personally torn quite often about this. And I live a happy life. Yeah. I don't sit around worrying about inflation or crime, except for professionally. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
but,
right.
But there's certainly a part of Biden that I find really refreshing and really likable. And then I see the left doing things that really concern me. And so I would say with my writing, I really view it as like sincerely, I view it as like constructive criticism. Like my goal is not to tear down Biden just so another Republican like Trump could get elected. It's like I am criticizing Biden with the hope that he will fix the things that I actually think. And I could be wrong too, but that I think are mistakes, or that the Democrats and the left will get their act together. And, you know, you mentioned I had Josh Krausser on my podcast. You know, he talks about Biden having this like malarkey moment, which would be kind of a sister soldier moment where Biden stands up to the left. And I kind of feel like he sort of maybe needs to do that, right? He went through the entire campaign. And, you know, Biden deserves a ton of credit for not taking the bait, for not following the crowd, for not supporting, you know, Medicare for all and defund the police. Like Biden was very shrewd, but he also never really confronted the left. And he won, right? So it's kind of hard to argue with success. Like he kind of kept his head down. He didn't directly confront them, but he managed to win in spite of them. But I just don't know if you can do that for 4 years. And I do feel like I'm not saying he has to, like, you know, do a Bill Clinton style takedown of the left. I don't know that he could do that if he wanted to. But I would be more comforted with a little bit of push if he were to push back a little bit against some of the excesses on the left.
See, I think the important thing that they need to understand is the one, I was going to say the one idiot rule, which I'm going to have to, you know, pay the price for using the term idiot. But the one idiot rule, which is that, you know, you may think that we live in an age in which the president of the United States with his bully pulpit sets the tone and defines his party, but that's not true any longer. You just need one person out there in Colorado who says something wacky or offensive or extreme, and that becomes the face of the Democratic Party for millions of voters. And you know what I mean? I mean, you just do a cherry pick. Yeah. You know, it's like, what does the Democratic Party hates America because Cori Bush said blank, or Ilhan Omar said blank. And so on this issue of crime, this is a problem. Let me read you from Texera's, and again, I'm apologizing again if I mispronounce his name, because I respect him tremendously. You know, he says this is a big effing deal for the Democrats. I mean, according to recent data from the Democratic-oriented Navigator Research, more Americans, including independents and Hispanics, now believe violent crime is a major crisis. They believe that is a bigger crisis than the coronavirus or other areas of concern. Meanwhile, majorities of even Democrats now believe violent crime is a major crisis, and concerns are sky high among Black voters. 70% say it's a major crisis. This is, as Biden might put it, a big effing deal. Democrats in competitive races are no doubt looking at data like this and at the Adams race in New York City and taking careful notes. They know they cannot afford to just run on the Biden boom. That's necessary but not sufficient. And Biden himself has started to address the issue, though it is not yet clear the extent to which he will be able to consolidate the rest of his party around a tough-on-crime approach. The ideological resistance is likely to be fierce. But a party that aspires to build a transformational coalition will have to overcome that resistance and base itself firmly on voters' needs and values, not ideology. Now, I think that's tough love. I think I agree with him. But you and I both know how tough that's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, just because the defund police folks have been humiliated in New York City does not mean they're going to be folding their tents anytime soon.
What they need to do is think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And, you know, basically what it says is that you can only get around to worrying about self-actualization after your basic needs are met. And so, like, yeah, maybe you care about the cisgendered patriarchy, but you can't really get around to voting on that if you're worried about getting mugged, you know, on the way to school.
This is good.
And so I think that's a real problem that, like, fear is a primal emotion. And if enough Americans have fear, they're not going to get around to worrying about, like, the niceties of gender pronouns or whatever, right? I mean, it's going to look a little silly because you can't even, like, you know, you're afraid for your safety or for your wife or for your kids. And, like, that's kind of where we're headed in cities right now. And that will trickle down. And I think it is a real fear. And then the other point that I would make is that there's certain, you know, issues have built in skews, and it's hard to change the way that these issues skew. And the truth is, like, if we're talking about crime, Republicans are usually winning. If crime is an issue, Republicans are usually going to win more often than they're going to lose. And so really, if Democrats want to win, like, their best strategy is not to ignore crime, but to make it a non-issue by solving it. If Democrats can either solve crime or just sort of live off the borrowed capital of Rudy Giuliani's tough on crime policies, then they can flourish. But if they can't, if crime becomes an issue again, it's very bad news. And I do not think they fully appreciate it. You know, Ezra Klein gets this. Yeah. He's been writing about this a long time at the New York Times. But most liberals, I don't think, fully appreciate the power of this.
No, I don't think they do. And I think that they think that if they talk about gun control, that somehow they've addressed the issue, which is not going to work for them. I think it is interesting. I'm starting to hear some voices in the Democratic Party who are beginning to, you know, raise concerns about bail reform and other things that have, you know, let loose a lot of very dangerous people on the streets. And I know that runs against the grain, but if you're in a city like New York, those are the things that were top of mind. Otherwise, how do you explain the result of that primary? So let's talk about J.D. Vance. I want to switch gears for a moment because you had a piece, and I was really struck by. And a lot of people have now written about, you know, and JD keeps talking and, you know, he's, you know, continuing talking about his evolution from being anti-Trump to being not just pro-Trump, but even Trumpier than Trump. It's like he's, you know, putting on a Trump mask costume. And now he's telling Time magazine that, in fact, he favored Josh Hawley's objection to the Electoral College. So he's all in on sort of the big lie and everything. And you refer to him as sort of the avatar, not sort of, you refer to him as the avatar of corruption in the GOP. So my question to you, Matt, is why would J.D. Vance be the avatar? There are so many others who have done this. What makes him stand out in your mind?
Well, I think it kind of goes to the Dan Crenshaw thing, which is to say that he's, there are some people that, you know, going Trumpy is a logical move for them, right? Like, I'm not sure Marjorie Taylor Greene has the chops to write like a best-selling novel or to make it through Navy SEAL boot camp. Maybe I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I would rather be, if it were me, I would rather be a beloved best-selling author of Hillbilly Elegy than I would a politician who very well could lose, right? I don't get the trade-off. I don't get it either. The hunger, the desire to be in public. Like, Ben Carson, think of the good. Think of the good that Dr. Ben Carson could have done for the pro-life movement. Here you have a world-famous African-American neurologist. He could have just talked about the dignity of life, and really advanced that one issue and otherwise remained apolitical. He could have been a rock star, a hero. I mean, my kid got a book from the library about him. And it was like, I forget, the blurbs on the back were like, you know, it was people like Jesse Jackson saying how great he was. You know,
they had a movie about made a movie about him. There are schools here in Milwaukee named after him. And he was a compelling speaker. I think I introduced him at two different dinners when he was here. And he was a very charismatic figure. I mean, talk about a guy who had a wonderful life and, you know, incredible respect, incredible prestige. And what did he do with it?
And J.D. Vance, I think, is one of those guys. I mean, this is somebody who, you know, Mona Charon has done a better job than me of sort of documenting his rags to riches up by his bootstraps story of coming from Appalachia and a very dysfunctional and chaotic environment, joining the Marine Corps, that sort of turning his life around. You know, did he go to what? Was it Harvard or
Yale Law School?
Yeah, it was Yale Law School. Yeah. And then, you know, made it big. You know, financially, and then wrote this really amazing best-selling book that captured the zeitgeist, just the stars aligned, the perfect moment. And now he's doing this. And that is why I think he stands out as someone a little bit different. Because when Trumpism can corrupt and seduce not just the losers who have no, you know, as Richard Gere said, I've got nowhere else to go. But J.D. Vance does have somewhere else to go.
Well, and yet
he still is susceptible to the siren call, you know, of MAGA. That is why I think he stands out.
Well, also, I mean, the fact is he had it right back in 2016. In fact, he had a very, very distinctive position. He understood the appeal of Trump to a certain group of voters, and he understood their concerns, their disillusionment, and he was able to articulate that. And that was a moment of real insight on his part to understand who these forgotten Americans were. And that's why he became so big, because he, in some ways, became the translator of that experience for the rest of America. But he also made the distinction that Trump was the wrong answer, that he was like injecting heroin to this group, that his proposals were either absurd or corrupt. And so he had a very clear view. He was able to distinguish the problem, the issues from the man. And yet he was not able to sustain that. And I guess that's part of the problem. He had a position that he could have, and again, could have been an important voice. He could have been a more important voice than even if he were to succeed, which I don't think he's going to, you know, as a junior senator from Ohio. So I don't know whether it's the seduction of, you know, having Peter Thiel, the billionaire, give him $10 million or brokering a meeting with the president in the White House. Maybe that
doesn't hurt.
I mean, if you or I had a Netflix movie, even if it was a shitty movie, we go, okay, you know, this is good. I've got a career path. I guess part of it is the willingness to engage in self-humiliation. You know, it's to, you know, bow the knee. And then the way he's doing it, that he feels the need to dumb himself down, to go with the most crudely nativist sort of approach. Back in 2016, he rejected Trump because he cared about people like immigrants, like Muslims, and he was concerned that Trump made them afraid, and this was wrong, and it was unchristian, and he wasn't going to have it. Well, now he's like all in on all of the Trumpian immigration policies, all of the cruelty, everything. You know, he's hanging out with the American greatness crowd. He's buying into the big lie. That's what I mean, I understand ambition. What I don't understand is the appetite for self-humiliation.
Me too. And I think maybe like we try to come up with noble reasons why we're not susceptible to this. And it may be that we're just too egotistical and proud that we're not willing to humiliate ourselves.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're like sadists, or maybe there's a weird, like, I don't know, thing going on. But look, I think what makes this, you know, and look, if J.D. Vance is into that sort of thing, you know, more power to him. The problem is, because he had such a refined and sophisticated and nuanced take and smart take on Trump and Trumpism and the impact, that Trump would actually have on working class whites, right? Like causing them to play the victim card or to perpetuate their brokenness rather than. Trump has a very unconservative message, which is basically you're a victim, you're being taken care of, you should be aggrieved, only I can save you, all those things. So because Vance was such a sophisticated critic of that, and now he has been turned, I think it's even more demoralizing. I mean, imagine if Maximilian Kolbe or Dietrich Bonhoeffer are released, from a concentration camp and then swear allegiance to Hitler and say that, we see these forced confessions, but it's even more dangerous when they're not forced. And the best spoof I've seen on this, Charlie, came from Robbie Suave.
I saw that.
Over at Reason. And he was linking to a piece about J.D. Vance apologizing for his criticism of Trump. And Suave tweets, quote, "It was all right. Everything was all right. The struggle was finished. He had won the victory over himself. He loved Donald Trump." Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's in 1984. Orwell.
It's the last page of 1984. Yeah. It's all right. He'd love Big Brother. And that's the happiness. You don't have to struggle anymore.
You have to laugh or you cry,
Yeah, I know. And that's what that really did capture, I think. So let me just switch back to one other issue that we were talking about earlier. Among the things that I find difficult to get my head around, I understand ambition. I understand the need to necessarily sometimes be a team player or even tribal. I'm willing to. This anti-vax thing is so extraordinary to me because we were talking about how, hey, things are going well. We're living happy lives. None of these things are particularly threatening us. The vaccine thing does threaten us. I mean, it has the potential to sicken millions of Americans. There's all sorts of, there's children who are not vaccinated or not going to be vaccinated anytime soon. And it seems, you use the word insane, which I think is better than, I was going to say irrational, but I think that it's worse than irrational what's happening now. This is a life-saving public health issue. And I guess I would have assumed at some point that just basic rationality, common sense would dictate that if this saves human lives and if it saves your life, the lives of people you love, lives of people in your community, that you would be in favor of it, or at least that you would not aggressively try to thwart it. And you're seeing it up and down, including Fox News. And I guess it's kind of pointless now talking about the irresponsibility of Fox News or the Murdochs allowing this to go out, because people will die as a result of this. And the people who complain about the shutdowns and the mask mandates and all of those things, you would think that they would recognize the way out of that is the vaccine. And so that's where it does feel like it's insane.
Yeah. It's really irrational.
Yeah.
I think that it is insane for, intelligent adults not to do it. I think it's evil for politicians to play games and to stoke this for political
purposes. I agree with you. And by the way, the word evil, needs to be used rarely. But this is going to be something that is – this will be unforgivable. I mean, we were talking about a little bit before, but you have to forgive certain people for certain votes they take. This is unforgivable. If at this moment, with that Delta variant spreading around the world, that you decide for clicks or whatever, you're going to spread this kind of bullshit. I mean, fuck you.
Yeah. No, and I was listening to a podcast you did the other day, and somebody on there said, Trump was talking about how Trump had this strategy not to do mail-in voting and to demagogue mail-in voting. And the point was, like, if they had been smarter about it and if they had, started legally challenging mail-in voting earlier, that they could have shut it down.
Yes.
But the thesis there assumes that mail-in voting was always going to hurt Republicans. It might not have. Mail-in voting hurt Republicans because Donald Trump told Republicans not to do mail-in voting. And so I think a lot of the problems that Trump has are really, you know, self-inflicted. And I think this is sort of, you know, one of them, right? I mean, like you were talking about how, you know, if Trump had owned this, had encouraged masks and had owned Operation Warp Speed, that alone might have won the election for him.
You know, you and I had these conversations even before Trump's nomination. Your book, Too Dumb to Fail, came out. What, it came out in 2015?
Yeah, so, okay, so the book came out, it published January 16th, 2016, which means I turned in, you know, in October of 2015, I turned in the manuscript.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you were turning in the manuscript, the Republican Party was still at that point going, you know, it's not going to be Trump. Something will come up. I mean, somebody will take a stand. I feel we're kind of back there right now that everybody's going, okay, you know, look, it'd be horrible. The guy's completely nuts. He's crazy. I mean, he's, you know, got all this baggage, but no one wants to be the one to stand up against, but they're hoping that something comes along. I actually think that anti-Trump at this point, the entire strategy and approach comes down to three words, Matt: maybe he'll die. Because they're not willing to do anything, and we're just sort of coasting along. And at this point, you know, short of that, I don't see how he doesn't get the nomination. And the Republican Party has got to be, are you serious? I mean, sure, there's 20% that think this is the most wonderful thing in the world, but the rest of them, I mean, Mitch McConnell is what, he's going to smile and get back on board. And yes, four more years of this shit.
I mean, it's his for the taking. Yeah. If he wants the nomination, nobody's going to stop him. And everybody's playing this like game that's like, someone else will do it, right? Or hey, man, don't freak out. Someone else will take care of it. Yeah. And like, no one ever does.
There'll be a lightning strike, or
and
I
Donald
don't know.
Trump will probably Sharks. Outlive everybody. Yeah. It's like cockroaches would survive a nuclear attack. Like Donald Trump, apparently, you know, he doesn't exercise because he realizes that exercising depletes your energy.
Science, man. Science.
And so maybe he's right, because I do feel like Donald Trump will live for like another 50, 60 years.
I think it's – so on that cheery thought, what else are you watching and looking at this week, Matt Lewis?
Well, actually, this was in my wheelhouse. I'm not watching too much. I'm right. So my next column is gonna be about the anti-vax, you know, paranoid style on the right. Then I'm gonna write a piece. I don't know if you saw this Kevin Drum blog post. You know, Kevin Drum is a liberal blogger. He was formerly at Washington Monthly and formerly at Mother Jones, and he talks about how actually, at least in the last 20 years, it has been the left, not the right, but the left, that has really pushed the culture war issues and made major gains and sort of accelerated that. So I'm going to take turns. My next two columns, one is going to be sort of a critique of the right, and the other one will be kind of a critique of the left. And I'm sure by Saturday, everyone's going to hate me again.
Well, you're used to being there. So welcome to that particular club, Matt Lewis. Matt, thanks for joining us on the podcast again. Appreciate it very much.
Always a pleasure, Charlie. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.